Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill. Happy to welcome back to the program today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, our friend Dr. Dunbar Graham. And we're going to be talking today about otitis and ear infections, and we're going to be talking about how you can help your animal feel better. We'll even take some calls. Our telephone number 352-392-8989. Hope you can join the conversation today. Animal Airwaves Live will be back after this news from NPR. Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT FM. I'm Dana Hill. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. So glad you could tune in this afternoon. I think today is, October 22nd? It's a new show today, and if you'd like to join the conversation a little bit later, I hope you'll think of doing that because our telephone number, 352-392-8989, and our topic today, ear infections, otitis, and our guest, our friend Dr. Dunbar Graham from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. So we're going to learn some interesting things about a problem that may affect plenty of animals, though we hope not too seriously. So welcome back to the show, Dr. Graham. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
So when we talk about ear infections and otitis in particular, is it a common ailment?
Second to itching and bacterial infections of the skin, ear infections are probably one of our top three presenting problems I see.
When we talk about infections, I think of, bacterial infections or viral infections. I don't necessarily think about, itchiness, right? There seems to be a disconnect, but it's connected somehow. Can you explain?
Yes, great point. Otitis technically means inflammation of the ear. And while there's normally small amounts of bacteria and yeast in the ear, they don't cause a problem unless you have that inflammation that encourages their overgrowth. So the real trick is to try to find out what's causing that inflammation. Now, if it's like a person who has seasonal allergies, a couple, 3 weeks in the spring and or fall, you can usually just simply medicate your way through that. But if it's becoming a problem where you're using antibiotics more and more, you risk developing a very resistant bacterial infection of the ear.
Yeah, resistant infections are kind of a nightmare scenario, particularly for an animal that might experience them on a regular basis, and then treatment becomes more and more challenging.
Exactly.
Okay, so you say about the third most common, but if we're talking about numbers, are you seeing cases every week even in the clinic?
Oh, every day we see several. There are days where half of my day is spent on ears.
Mm-hmm. Wow, okay. Are we talking primarily about dogs?
Primarily dogs. We see them in cats, but not near as common as we do dogs. Most of your cases of ear issues in cats would be associated with a parasite called ear mites.
Ear mites, okay. When we talk about something like otitis, can you walk me through a typical case? Let's say a dog comes in. What are you looking for?
You know, the big view of otitis is sometimes it can be a problem only located in the ears, and the dog is manifesting it by shaking its head or scratching. Upon closer examination or maybe a little more questioning, you'll find out that he licks at his paws, chews at the feet, rubs at his behind a bit more. And those are all indications that there's something going on than just the ear component of the disease. But some dogs who are allergic only manifest with their ear problems.
Mm. Okay, so an animal comes in and maybe the pet owner has described some of those different symptoms. What are you looking at? You're maybe taking a real close look at the skin in these different parts of the dog.
We look at the different parts of the skin, but also look at the skin down in the ear canal itself. And a very common test that we do is we do a cytology of the ears, which involves something similar to a Q-tip that you swab through the ear and then roll out on a microscopic slide, do a special stain, and look under the microscope to see what organisms, bacteria or yeast. Those would be the most common. Viral ear infections are actually exceptionally rare.
Ah, okay. What should the ear look like inside if it's healthy?
The difference in the ear, actually, we separate it into two main sections from our point of view. Right where the eardrum is and outward is called the external ear. And that's the most common type of otitis that I see, otitis externa. When children get ear infections, it's more commonly otitis media, or an infection of the middle ear. So although the symptoms can show up in either place in a dog, most cases in the dog start off with otitis externa, sometimes get so severe that the ear drum is ruptured, and then we can end up with a middle ear infection as well.
Okay. So that sounds both horrifying and painful. Are dogs that experience these infections, are they in a great deal of pain?
It varies depending on the severity of the disease. And an analogy I use that's somewhat adequate, I would emphasize, it's a little bit like a person with allergies and an itchy or runny or congested nose. Initially, it starts as an annoyance, but eventually it can be darn near disabilitating and painful. So there's different degrees.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, you know, if you're a dog and you don't really have a great ability to just kind of scratch wherever you want, whenever you want, I mean, you've got paws and not necessarily like totally useful fingers like you were and I might enjoy. If I've got an itch somewhere, I can probably figure out a way to reach it and sort of satisfy that. But for a dog, you know, discomfort kind of down in the ear, I mean, they're really probably like scratching at their heads pretty vigorously.
They scratch at it to the point that sometimes you can actually get a little blood vessel popping in the ear flap, and you'll get almost an egg shape. We call them aural hematomas, A-U-R-A-L hematoma. Sometimes they rub the head back and forth on the carpet. Sometimes they're just simply depressed and not themselves, just like us when we're battling an allergy or a cold. In really severe cases, you may go to pet their head and they flinch like they know it's going to be uncomfortable.
So someone who's brought in an animal that is experiencing some of these symptoms, you'll, as a veterinarian, kind of know right away that what you suspect is the problem.
Coupled with my exam and the history, I can typically narrow it down to maybe three or four things that are causing it. And I want to emphasize that usually I'll find bacteria or yeast, and usually I can clear those up. But the trick is, why did those overgrow to start with?
And
that's the part that takes a lot of figuring out.
Okay. So you mentioned a history. Are you likely to find otitis in an animal that has experienced it in the past?
The ones that I see, certainly. Now, a primary care practitioner will sometimes see it the first time that it happens. But by the time I see it as a specialist, that there's usually been many, many months of treatment on and off, sometimes even years, because they've had it twice a year for 4 or 5 years. And then last year it was 4 times. And this year they haven't been able to get it under control because the bacterial infection has become very resistant to treatment by then.
Can we talk a little bit about the bacteria itself? Explain kind of how it reproduces or spreads or becomes such a problem.
Great. Thank you. So normally in the ear, we have staph, the same type of organism that people usually have, and Malassezia or yeast. And those are the microbes that are normal in the ear in small numbers. They'll take advantage of abnormal situations, excessive warmth, excessive moisture, and overgrow, and that's just what they'd like to do under the right circumstances. And then as they overgrow, they cause more inflammation, which encourages more overgrowth, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then the next thing you know, the ear can be very swollen and painful. And it's really sad when you see a happy dog obviously uncomfortable with its ears.
Left untreated, does the body just not have a practical way to fight this off?
So another excellent point as usual. So there's a theory that's called epithelial migration, and it's just the way the ear rids itself of its normal ear wax and all of that. And basically, the cells just slowly climb up and out of the ear and help get rid of excessive bacteria, earwax, and skin cells. When there's too much inflammation going on in there, it overwhelms that normal system, and it starts to build up almost like a beaver dam, if you will. It just starts backing up on the inside, and that's when we run into the danger of it puncturing the eardrum and going into the middle ear.
So some of the cases that you're seeing are probably on the severe side, the most uncomfortable side, the sort of most, I don't know, frequent cases maybe for an animal that's had the problem quite a few times.
Indeed. Sometimes they see us because the last resort would be actually surgical removal of the ear canal. So they see us to try to avoid that drastic of a surgery. But some diseases have progressed to the point that the cartilage has turned to bone and there really is no going back without a surgical intervention.
Ouch. So, I mean, left completely untreated, not only could this be very, very uncomfortable for the animal, might it lead to, say, hearing loss?
Oh, absolutely. Hearing loss, nerve deficits. Some dogs with really extreme ear infections can get a palsy. It looks almost like they've had a stroke because the inflammation has affected the nerve conduction of the nerves to their face and their eyes. They can get eye problems associated with it.
Oh, well, this sounds tragic. So would you say, on whole, The diagnosis and treatment of this, is it a complex sort of thing, or is it an eminently treatable kind of condition if the right set of circumstances sort of come together and the dog is seen by a veterinarian?
The wonderful thing is that we have terrific drugs that address the infections and the inflammation. The times that it becomes problematic is when the underlying problem is persistent enough that it continues to cause recurrence of the problems. And that's where the real challenge begins, identifying the underlying reason.
Okay. So, you know, let's talk about some of what you're looking at in the microscope. You say you take a sample. You put it on a slide and there's some stain. What do you see under the microscope that lets you know specifically that it's the condition that we're talking about today?
So the most common things we see are the staphylococcal bacteria, and they're just little polka dots. And then the second most common thing we see would be yeast, which look a little bit like bowling pins or snowmen, and they're maybe 4 to 5 times bigger than the cocci. And occasionally we'll see some gram-negative organisms like Pseudomonas or E. coli. Many people are familiar with that. That's a relatively rare one. And those are all infections that we have good medications for the most part, unless they're very resistant, that we can clear up the infections.
I'm going to go ahead and ask my director, Richard, to tell me the name of the caller because I don't have the computer screen up and going in here today. Let's go to the phones and talk to Nancy. Thank you so much, Richard. Nancy, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live.
Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for calling.
I have a question. I have had two cats who have had, I guess they're calling it idiopathic vestibular syndrome. And then I have a neighbor whose dog had it. And I'm not sure, I mean, I know idiopathic means we don't know what really causes it, but I was wondering if the doctor could address, is there any new information about this?
Okay, thank you, Nancy. Go back to your to radio and let's see what we can sort
okay,
of...
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Dr. Graham, I am not familiar with some of these terms, so maybe you could sort of enlighten me and the audience and tell us what this is that Nancy is asking about.
That too is a great question. Idiopathic is a term that makes me cringe because it means that I haven't figured out what's causing it. And although not my specialty, many of those idiopathic vestibular syndromes really fall into the realm of neurology. It is something that I'm somewhat familiar with and differentiate. So when we have a patient who comes in with these where they've lost their balance, which means now that they're inner ear, something we've not yet talked about, is affected. The question is it otitis externa that progressed to otitis media and then to otitis interna. So the idiopathic ones seem to be mostly neurologically related. It's quite unusual to have two cats in the same household, unless you're like me and have maybe a lot of cats who show up with it. Having seen it in my own personal dogs, it's often transient in dogs, but can leave some lingering effects like the palsy I was talking about, the neurologic effects. And it's a little more common in older dogs. In cats, it's really somewhat rare, says the dermatologist. I'm not sure what the neurologist would say with that. To my knowledge base, I'm not familiar with any of the new latest and greatest ideas behind the idiopathic vestibular syndrome in cats or dogs. So I'm sorry, I'm not a wealth of information regarding
that.
No,
it's quite all right. Perhaps a topic for a future episode. Let's go back to the phones. Let's talk to Anne in Dunellen. Anne, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live.
Thanks for taking my call. I've had poodles for over 30 years, and I usually have two. And I've gotten ones to rescue. They had bad ear infections. And once they're treated, I've been able to prevent, I don't know if this is why, but I keep the ear hair short, especially if they go swimming. And I never let any water get in the ear. I put like vet solution or nothing and then cotton balls. And I was wondering if that's true, that keeping water out of the ears and keeping the ear fur short does help prevent ear infections.
That's a fascinating question.
Ooh, this is one of my favorite topics. So you've allowed me to split our problems that contribute to ear infections up into four groups. We have secondary problems, which would be the bacteria and yeast that are normally present there in low numbers that don't really cause a problem unless they have a reason to overgrow. And the things that contribute to overgrowth would be a primary problem, like having something stuck down in the ear or an allergy or something like dogs get something like psoriasis that causes extra skin cells to be produced. But then we have things that we'll call predisposing factors. And in poodles in particular, it's the excessive amount of hair in their ears. Sometimes it's dogs who swim every day, and that excessive moisture can encourage the bacteria or the yeast to overgrow. So by keeping the hair plucked or cut short, you're allowing a little better air supply down in there by keeping the ear from getting wet or excessive moisture. Again, you're doing, I think, very prudent things to discourage the overgrowth of bacteria and yeast. Now, it can be controversial whether or not you should pluck ear hairs. And I'm one of those people where, I guess I should say veterinarian, who believe in some cases it's appropriate and some cases it's not. So it's very individualized for me. But I have some poodle breeders that are passionate about plucking the hair out of the ear to keep it clean and dry, and others who go, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, leave it alone.
Well, Anne, it sounds like you say you've prevented this problem from becoming a bigger issue, right?
Yes, I've gotten dogs with ear infections, but I've outside the first one where I had very long ear hair and I let it swim, I've never had them have an infection while I've owned them for over 30 years, two at a time. So,
well, that sounds like at least it seems to be working for you, however it is that it's working for you. So I really appreciate the call and the question, and thanks for tuning into the show today.
We love you. I love your show.
Dr. Graham, go ahead. You were going to add something.
And it sounds like you're great at preventing those facilitating factors that overgrow it, and you've been very fortunate to have lines of dogs who don't have an underlying primary problem such as environmental allergies or food allergies that would cause the ears to be a little warm and a little more moist than normal. So congratulations on 30 years of having great dogs. I love poodles.
Thanks so much, Anne. I appreciate the call. Dr. Graham, you said that we've got some secondary sort of causes, right? Bacteria, yeast, and the things that sort of go along with that. I mean, when we talk about things like bacteria or yeast, can veterinarians say definitively that there is an acceptable range before something like that starts to become an issue?
For me, I put it in maybe the 80-20 or 90-10 rule. 80 to 90% of the animals will have, on a scale of 1 to 4, 0 to 1 bacteria or yeast as normal. in my experience, I've had some who have what I would call 4-plus bacteria or 4-plus yeast and no symptoms whatsoever. So they just like to carry more yeast or bacteria, but it doesn't cause them a problem. And that's perhaps because they don't have the underlying problem that causes more inflammation and slowing down their normal ear cleaning mechanism that the ear does on its own.
Okay. So is it that some animals just don't experience the same allergic reaction?
Absolutely.
Okay. What contributes to an animal's allergy, that is, say, the kind of allergic response to a condition like this?
The most common types of allergies that we see that contribute to ear problems would be an environmental allergies, pollens, grasses, weeds, trees, dust mite, mold, North Florida. Food allergies, quite rare, but if I had to choose, I would pick that as my underlying allergy because theoretically it'd be easier to control what we eat than what I am exposed to in the air.
Now, I've heard time and again on this program that food allergies are sort of less common than maybe people sometimes believe.
Absolutely. Although they're much less common than environmental allergens, they're so important because you can control them without medication.
Right. And, you know, by and large, it's probably not a terribly expensive thing. You just change the food a little bit and find something that works for your pet. And there you go. Everything's going great. However, might people do themselves a disservice if the problem is not a food allergy, spending a great deal of time trying to find a food that makes the dog feel better when in fact it could be something else, and maybe a trip to the veterinarian would help diagnose it more definitively?
Excellent point. Food allergy, when I see patients, sometimes my clients have already figured out what they're allergic to through trial and error, which is great when you can do it that way. They typically see me when they have something else, perhaps environmental allergies going on at the same time. There are some new options in diet selection that help cut to the chase and find out, are we food allergic or not? And then we can change different diets to identify what we're allergic to.
I don't mean to go on a big detour here from the topic, but briefly, can you describe what some of that is? Because that's fascinating.
So the only way to diagnose food allergy is through a change in diet. In spite of what you may read various places, there's even salivary tests where people try to sell you that this will be able to identify food allergy. There's not a blood test, there's not a skin test, there's not a salivary test that will identify food allergy. The only way to diagnose food allergy is through a stringently performed hypoallergenic diet or novel protein diet, something that they've not eaten before. You have to be so careful. Even the flavored heartworm preventions or parasite control products can interfere with those tests. The difficult thing is, even if your pet's food allergic and you go on the perfect diet, if you haven't cleared up the infection, the ear problem will continue to self-perpetuate itself. So you have to address both the infection as well as the underlying problem at the same time. When we try to find the diet that would be novel or unique, in the old days, if you will, pretty much all the diets were either chicken or beef-based. But now so many over-the-counter products have lamb or various other novel substances. The dog food companies really have risen to the occasion, so to speak, and developed hydrolyzed diets where it's very similar to infants who are allergic to baby formula. The protein components have been broken down so small that they cannot or should not or rarely will cause an allergic reaction in dogs. And we feed that very strictly for 2 months while addressing the infections and then reevaluate and determine, do we re-expose to one of the previous diets and watch for a flare-up.
Thank you for that explanation. When Anne was on the telephone, we were hearing about how she tried to prevent water from kind of getting into the ears. And can you explain how that might contribute to an ear infection, whether or not that's even a practical thing for pet owners to be able to do? Because in the sort of fun summer times, there's going to be some playing in the hose, maybe a swim in the pool or the lake. you know, you got to bathe your dog too.
Right.
How can one really do a job preventing something as common as exposure to water?
So water poses a couple of different risk factors with it. One, if it's icky or yucky water, then there's disgusting bacteria that we just don't want exposure to. And dogs, many of them don't care. So we make sure we clean afterwards. But the other thing that water can do, particularly if there's a contributing factor that keeps the water in the ear longer, it actually softens the skin and macerates it, or to the point, just think about if we spend too much time in the bathtub or the hot mm-hmm. tub and our fingers swell and look funny, that causes little microscopic cracks and disruptions in the normal barrier that the skin provides. And those little fissures and cracks give a place for the bacteria and yeast to overgrow and take advantage of the situation.
Okay. So that makes perfect sense. So if someone knows that he or she has a dog that is somewhat predisposed to something like otitis or other sorts of ear infections, is limiting contact with water in the ear, for instance, a wise and prudent move?
You know, I want dogs to lead their happy life. So if they like to swim, then I come up with a plan somewhat similar to what swimmer's ear plan would be. After you enjoy the water, just make sure you put a drying agent down in the ear to dry it out. But if I have a dog who doesn't like to swim, then I just try not to expose them to excessive amounts of water. If I'm bathing them, then just afterwards, again, I pick a drying agent that would just dry the water out of the ear afterwards. Or just like the caller mentioned, simply keeping the water from getting in there to start with is an excellent way too. Different dogs, different personalities, different situations. So lots of different ways to handle that.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, speaking with Dr. Dunbar Grand from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm talking today to our friend from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Dunbar Graham. And we're talking today about otitis and other sort of skin problems that may cause our pets discomfort. And when we left off, Dr. Graham, we had been talking about some of the things that might contribute to otitis and ear infections. Let's talk about some environmental factors. We had talked about kind of like allergic responses to things, and you had mentioned some, you know, different things that animals can be allergic to, and it was kind of a litany of things that make up the environment of Gainesville in North Central Florida, alas. But what other kind of environmental problems or factors might contribute to some of these skin problems?
So in addition to the pollens and dust mites and molds, excessive humidity can contribute to it. Just bugs, meaning bacteria and yeast, like to grow in warm, moist environments. We have less of a problem in drier, less rainy, less humid climates. But those areas can also have environmental allergies that are a little more episodic associated with the pollination of those plants.
So it wouldn't do us good to move to Death Valley because we would still probably have find something that might cause allergies on our pets.
It can be of some help, but usually after 2 or 3 years, the dog's immune system figures out a way to be allergic to those, maybe just not as many months out of the year as they would.
So why doesn't the immune system work in the opposite way? And why doesn't the immune system say, you know what? I live in Florida. It's humid all summer long, and there's pollen, and there's this and that. I'm just going to figure out a way to fight it off, and I will be a super dog.
That's you're alluding to something I'm very fond of. It's called the hygiene hypothesis, and allergies and autoimmune disease, and my own way of looking at this with a little bit of science, a little bit of Southern Alabama practicality, which is where I went to high school, is that for eons, our immune systems have been geared up to help us survive life-threatening infectious diseases. And in our modern society, our dogs just aren't exposed to that, which some people claim is good. Obviously, I agree with that. Some people complain is bad, only because we get more of these allergies going on with it. As I say, I'd much rather fight off an allergy than the plague. So that when I have infectious diseases, I want to be able to prevent those with vaccinations. And I'm just super excited about where our field is going and trying to balance normalizing the immune response so that our immune system can tell life-threatening from non-life-threatening diseases and normal things from abnormal things. The biology of mammals and is a fascinating, diverse topic.
And I hope we can circle back around to that. But let's go back to the phones. Let's talk to Will in Citra. Will, welcome to Animal Airwaves Live.
Thank you. I love this show.
I appreciate it.
I'm on a very limited budget when it comes to me and my dog. I had some questions about the old school treatments and things like that. Like I used to have a German Shepherd that swam quite a bit, and my mother used to put, the fizzy stuff.
Like Alka-Seltzer. Hydrogen peroxide, sure.
Hydrogen peroxide in her ears after she'd go swimming sometimes. And she, you know, said it would dry it out. I didn't know if alcohol or hydrogen peroxide, can you use that in a dog's ear as a drying agent?
You know, that is something to check with your veterinarian about. I am not one of those people who offer the absolutely not view of that. In fact, careful use of diluted alcohol or diluted vinegar can be wonderful at helping dilute or dry out the ears. Rather, peroxide, although some of my clients use it very successfully, does pose a risk factor in that the bubbling nature of the peroxide could potentially increase the pressure within the ear to the point that you could traumatize the eardrum. I think that in many cases that risk factor is overblown, but it does lead me to suggest caution when using that or full-strength alcohol or full-strength vinegar in those situations.
All right. My mother also gave her – she had a Shepherd that had hip dysplasia, and this dog lived a very long time, 13 years. She used to give it one of those coated time-release 81 milligram aspirins every day for her hip pain. And she said it actually, you know, and it made the dog move easier. She was convinced. Is aspirin safe for a dog?
Well, now, as a dermatologist, that's not my field of expertise, but I know from listening to the other, there are dosages that are safe in the dog, but you need to run that by your veterinarian, and you also have to be very careful that they're not on other concurrent medications as well. But I really appreciate your call, because in today's world, it can be a challenge to balance providing good care for your pet against the cost of some of these medications for arthritis. It can run $3 or $5 a day. So good common sense with good conversations with your veterinarian about what's best for you and your pet are crucial. As sounds like your mom was wonderful because she was able to get a German Shepherd to 13 years of age, which is no small feat.
And thank you very much for the call, Will. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
So long. You know, Will brings up an important point, and it's something that we've discussed on the show before. Now, a veterinarian will likely be very glad to talk to you about sort of budget-conscious ways to take good care of your pet. We should, though, caution listeners that it is not wise to, without any kind of consultation, just go giving any old, like, human medication to a pet.
Absolutely. For instance, a single Tylenol can kill a cat. So sometimes Dr. Mom is excellent. In fact, a lot of times Dr. Mom or Dr. Dad is excellent. But it's also good to just double check with your veterinarian about steps that you can take at home.
Absolutely. So let's go back a little bit to some environmental factors and say that, you know, if we're talking about where we live here in North Central Florida and we've got bad humidity and we've got all these different pollens and trees and you know, different kinds of things in the air, What is one to do to help make life easier for an animal that might otherwise be predisposed to allergic reactions?
I do get that question from clients who've had pets who'd literally suffered for a lifetime with allergic disease, either with ear problems or chewing at their feet, scratching at their body. There are steps that you can do to lower the overall amount of inflammation in the body, being careful with your diet, being proactive at keeping infections from getting ahead of the curve and perpetuating things. And I sometimes joke, I wish I had a crystal ball so I could tell which pets 3 years later would need more aggressive therapy early on. And unfortunately, it does come down to just carefully watching your pet, talking with your veterinarian about what they feel is likely to occur. Certain breeds are more likely to progress to bad ear disease, like a Cocker Spaniel. Some retrievers can have it quite bad.
Okay, great point. Do floppy ears have greater incidence of problems like this?
So I look at those as predisposing factors, because it is a little bit like sealing the plastic bag and covering up all that moisture down in there. So it is a predisposing factor, just like hairy ears or swimming can be. But usually there's an additional primary disease that tips us over the edge to where we run into problems. And food allergies or environmental hay fever kind of allergies manifesting as skin problems and ear problems are very common.
To begin talking about treatments, a moment ago you referred to sort of allergies and the way bodies respond. And I think about the way that I treat any allergies that I may have. And listeners may find this especially amusing coming from me, but I am allergic to my own cat. And this is trouble, of course, because when I wake up and Moggy is sleeping on my neck, it's no wonder that I wake up feeling kind of congested because my sinuses are closed up because I've got this cat who just rubs her face on my face. And I am able, though, to take a kind of medication that allows me to live a full and happy life and get along very well with this animal that lives so close to me. Is there such a thing as just allergy medication for our dogs or our cats that we can just offer them like you or I might take something?
So one of the oldest allergy medications would be steroids, which are a little stronger than we like to use sometimes. Various antihistamines can be useful, and all of these need to be run by your pet's veterinarian. There's some excellent newer drugs out there as well that help block itching and block inflammation. The great yet sometimes frustrating thing about our body is that if you stop one pathway that leads to a problem, the body's biology figures out another way to continue to cause problems. So in the ideal world, we could live in a bubble or something like that and not be continually exposed to it. A rule of thumb, and it's purely a rule of thumb, is for my pets, if they're a breed that's predisposed to progression or using their medication for more than 3 or 4 months out of the year, that's when I start thinking about allergy testing and allergen-specific immunotherapy, somewhat similar to what people go through.
And what does that look like?
That can look like we don't do that test to prove that an allergy is present. That diagnosis is made based on our history and our physical exam. We do two different types of tests. We prefer doing the skin scratch test, where you actually prick the skin and inject with a little bit of pollens or dust or molds or fleas. At the University of Florida, we test for 61 different things, and you watch for the little bug bite, if you will, to spread into a little hive. And the bigger the reaction, the more the immune system is responding to it. We also have a blood allergy test option. But then in that situation, we're just testing for the allergy components in the blood, not necessarily in the skin where the disease is occurring. And from those reactions, we can then make up a mixture of allergy shot solution to help, as you mentioned earlier, train the immune system that a little bit of this is okay. Don't freak out. Don't cause an allergy. And those are helpful depending on the pet and the stage of the disease, anywhere from 75 to 85%, but can take 3 to 12 months till they start working. So that's one reason people often wait to decide if we need to pursue that route.
You mentioned earlier that something like otitis might come around a couple times a year. Is there any underlying cause that might make it, I don't know if the cyclical is the right word, but is there any reason you can think of that a pet might get it multiple times a year? And would those be at, say, certain intervals?
Exactly. So certain times a year, the pollen counts are higher when the trees are out and we find it all over the pollen all over our cars. Fall allergy season would be almost an episodic, which sometimes we can equate with a cyclical seasonal issue. Sometimes it's simply when they go on vacation and the dog is swimming every day. In rare cases, it's a dietary component that they're exposed to on a somewhat seasonal basis. It really depends on the pet. What we see most common in Florida is they go back up north and the pollen is not as bad, or they go up, travel at Christmas time and everything goes away. Then the moment they come back, then the allergies start. It's a little bit like us when we get out our seasonal decorations and start sneezing. We've gotten into the dust and our allergies are kicking in.
For sure. Now, when we talk about treatments and we talk about otitis, Can you offer sort of like a description of the way an animal might be treated going from sort of beginning to end? Like, let's say the animal has come in, has seen a veterinarian has made a diagnosis of otitis. What from there, be it a mild case or a severe case?
So a mild case, the veterinarian will look down in the ear, look under the microscope, decide the best medication to get rid of the infection. And then based on our history and the other parts of the exam, is that all we need at this point in time? Because the vast majority of them, there's some products out that you only need to put in once or twice and it's gone within 2 weeks, as long as the underlying problem has come and gone as well. So it's the veterinarian and the client's call to some degree whether or not we need to reevaluate to make sure that the wax is not building back up again. Keeping in mind that as a specialist, I see the ones where the rechecks were not followed through, the wax buildup perpetuated. So I'm a little more sensitive about insisting on reevaluation than would be necessary in a general practice. And then approximately 2 weeks later, we reevaluate, make sure we're making progress. And I look in the microscope, I look in the ear again, and sometimes in 2 weeks it can shift from a bacterial infection to a yeast infection or from a staph infection to an E. coli infection. It can really change very, very quickly, sometimes without the caregiver, the client, realizing it without being able to look down in the ear and look under the microscope. The vast majority of them respond within 1 to 2 weeks of treatment. Some of them go on and perpetuate and can be quite problematic, and those are the ones I often end up with.
Ah, I see. So you deal with some of the bigger challenges. Do you nevertheless find successful treatments and help these animals feel better?
It's absolutely. It's often easier to control the infection. The real challenge is getting at that underlying problem, because doing the special diet change takes a couple of months. To do the allergy testing and allergen-specific immunotherapy can take 3 to 12 months. So I have to find a balance of medications that will help control the symptoms, whether it be something like an antihistamine pill or a routine ear cleaning agent. Just like some people with allergies do steroid sprays in their nose, we find something that will control the symptoms while we're trying to control the underlying problem.
Well, because really, treating the symptoms long-term is not the best solution, right? It's finding the cause and mitigating that factor.
I love Band-Aids. If you're bleeding or something, you've got to stop the discomfort, got to stop the bleeding. But if it continues to happen, we need to figure out what's going on.
Where do you see treatments in the future. Do you see that there's going to be more success dealing with some of these stubborn problems?
We've already made such great advances, literally just in the past 2 or 3 years, with some of the medications that don't typically work in my hands. But for first-line otitis, you can see your veterinarian. They can put a medication in the ear, and it doesn't need to be treated for two weeks, just reevaluated then. But then the bigger question is getting at that underlying problem to try to retrain the immune system to act normally. And there is great research going on in that arena. I don't think we'll ever know the full picture because, as I said, the body usually figures out some way to do it wrong.
There's so many different things that can contribute to skin problems and itching and discomfort. As a veterinary dermatologist, you probably see so many different things every day that it must from time to time seem that our environment is trying to overwhelm all of us and just make us feel really bad constantly. When we talk about treatments and potential treatments in the future, is it possible that we will ever be able to do something like take a medication that will render many of nature's sort of, cruel annoyances somewhat less vexing?
I think the character of somewhat less vexing is very wise, because we can blunt the discomfort and blunt the immune system. But sometimes when we cover up a symptom or use a Band-Aid, we're forgetting the underlying reason for that. And I, outside of this field, we really are looking at changing the genetic basis for who we are to some degree. We're genetically pre-programmed to be allergic. Our environment colludes with our abnormal genetics, or normal genetics perhaps, to cause the disease. And what we find sometimes is when you select away from one part of genetics, you may end up with a separate set of problems in that category.
Yeah. So it's a challenge. Lastly, before you go, as everyone in the area notices today, we're finally, mercifully, leaving our warm season behind and are going to enjoy some cool weather. What changes in the cooler season that may or may not contribute to allergic reactions?
So although somewhat rare here, a frost works to kill off the weeds, which is the most common thing blooming right now. So that puts an immediate end to the environmental part of the weed allergies. But then sometimes the dead and decaying plants, mold will grow on that, and then we get a little bit of moisture and a little bit of fall breeze, and the next thing you know, you're sneezing as the leaves are blowing around. The other thing often overlooked is, as fleas are a component of itching, less so in ear problems, but many people start to slack off on their flea control this time of year, whereas in reality, fleas love it probably between 75 and 85 degrees and 75 to 85% humidity, which we still have plenty to do. So you may not be overwhelmed with the flea burden, but they can still be contributing to the itching.
So don't let your guard down. Continue the treatments that your veterinarian has suggested to you, and just kind of keep guard. You do your best to treat the conditions that you've noticed that your pet has. You meet with your veterinarian whatever year, certainly for a checkup, and you follow the instructions, and you hope you have a healthy, happy animal.
Exactly.
All right. Well, Dr. Dunbar Graham from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, thank you so much for coming back and speaking to us today. I really appreciate it. I always love our conversations. I want to say thank you to our listeners and our callers as well, and to Richard Drake, who directs the show in the room, Sarah Carey and her staff over at the College of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Dana Hill. Thanks for listening today. I hope you will tune in again for another episode of Animal Airwaves Live. Bye-bye.